You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, the Hmong Veterans Service Recognition Act passed Congress last month and was signed into law by President Trump. We'll find out what it means for Southeast Asian veterans who fought on behalf of the U.S. in the so-called Secret War. First, it's estimated that about 10,000 baby boomers a day are retiring nationwide. Add to that a low unemployment rate in Wisconsin and competition among employers for workers, and the state could be headed for trouble in being able to fill open jobs. Our next guest says that despite national rhetoric about the need to curb immigration, in fact, we might need more immigrants coming to Wisconsin for the economy to grow. David D. Haynes is editorial editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he recently wrote a piece addressing this tension. He joins us from our WPR studios in Milwaukee. David, good to have you back on Central Time.
Hey, thanks so much, Judith. Good to be here.
We laid out some of the factors that are causing such a tight labor market in Wisconsin, but let's dig into those. Wisconsin hit an all-time record low rate of unemployment in February of 2.9%. That's actually below what is considered full employment. What does that mean for people who are trying to fill jobs?
Well, it's tough, particularly in certain industries. And added on to that, and you mentioned it in your opening, we have a number of people who are marching off toward retirement. About one in four Wisconsin manufacturing workers are at least 55 years old, and that's nearly 125,000 workers in a key industry. And as you project that out, and the population lab at UW-Madison has done this, you look at 15, 20 years down the road, and unless we make some changes and attract more people of some kind, we're going to have large swaths of the state that are in retirement. So that is a problem for states in the upper Midwest. Wisconsin isn't the only one. Minnesota is talking a lot about this as well.
When we talked about those unemployment figures when they came out, the data showed that while more people than ever are working, wages are still stagnant. So what does that do to employers trying to lure workers from other geographic areas?
Well, it's interesting because there's a real debate right now about whether we actually have a labor crunch now or whether it's something more to worry about in the future. And Mark Levine at UW-Milwaukee, who has studied the labor market here in Milwaukee for many years, isn't convinced there's really a labor crunch because, as he says, if you had one, you would actually see those wages rising. And we're not seeing that. We are seeing, though, some companies pay bonuses. I saw a piece in the Washington Post this morning that one of the big railroads is offering up to $25,000 to line workers to try to attract people.
Would that be like a bonus or?
Bonus.
Wow.
Right.
So what particular industries are hardest hit today by that fierce competition for qualified workers?
Well, I think it's in manufacturing for sure, and it's in certain areas of manufacturing. And ladle on to that, in southern Wisconsin, we have the Foxconn plant, which, if you believe the projections, could employ up to 13,000 people. And so that's a real challenge just to build it. That plant's going to be enormous. And so in the construction trades with the new arena, the new Bucks Arena downtown here in Milwaukee, just a couple of blocks from where I'm sitting, they're already having trouble filling construction jobs. So that's going to be, I think, a key area of concern.
So how would bringing more immigrants to Wisconsin help in these key areas that are on the horizon?
Well, immigrants, and first of all, let me point out that Wisconsin also, this issue is compounded because we have a lower than average birth rate compared to the nation as a whole, and we haven't been very good at attracting workers from other states. Now, the governor has argued, and some of the people I talked to said this could happen, including Mark Levine, that Foxconn might, in fact, while it's a challenge with the jobs, might, in fact, be a magnet as well. But immigrant labor tends to be younger people who tend to replenish the workforce. As I mentioned, right now we have a workforce that's aging pretty rapidly. We're older than the norm compared with other states in the nation. And so that's a real advantage of immigrants. And you have to keep in mind, and Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce has said this, that you really need immigrant labor at both the sort of the top end, highly skilled, but also at the lower end, lower skilled labor.
We're talking right now with David D. Haynes. He's editorial editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and wrote a recent piece saying that Wisconsin may need to actively recruit more immigrants to come to the state to help with a very tight labor market. And on a Facebook, Travis said employers want a $75,000 skill set but only want to pay you $50,000. That seems to kind of get at that point of wages being pretty stagnant right now.
Well, they are, and it's a good point, and I think that's why you're seeing not only manufacturers, but companies of all kinds pay a premium in the form of a bonus to attract people, but they're really reluctant to raise wages. Part of that has to do with competition offshore from competitors in other countries where wages are lower. That's been a problem we've faced in the upper Midwest now for going on 30 years. But there's no doubt that is a prevalent concern.
David, in the piece you wrote for the Journal Sentinel on this, there seem to be people from all parts of the political spectrum who are seeing this problem on the horizon and agree with your premise that immigration could be at least part of the answer. What does that kind of agreement across the spectrum say to you about how serious the situation is?
Well, it says to me that people are beginning to understand it. Kurt Bauer, the president of WMC, the biggest business lobby in the state, has been actually ringing this bell for a few years now, not only in immigration, but just on the idea of a labor crunch coming. But others now are as well. And I think what it says to me is that the business community and the population generally, if you look at polling from places like Pew and others, people support immigration reform, which would get at some of the issues we're talking about. But I think the people in the business community are ahead of our government right now, and that's going to be the challenge.
So where is the disconnect there? If people in the business community see this problem, are putting out some possible solutions or ways to address it, but the government obviously has a role in some of this, where does the pressure need to come from if what's coming from the business community isn't enough to move the political meter?
Well, it's a great question. It's easy to block a bill, and keep in mind that immigration is not cost-free, and those costs are not borne by the federal government so much as they're borne by state and local governments. So particularly states and localities along the border, which have more of an issue than we do with the problems of immigration, the costs of immigration, have been quite vocal, and in a world where our districts are gerrymandered and you can block legislation, it becomes more difficult. But I do think that this job crunch, this labor crunch that appears to be on the horizon, could be the motivating factor to get legislators finally off the couch on this one.
The state of Wisconsin is currently working to recruit young workers from the Chicago area to move to Wisconsin with an ad campaign. What kind of effort would be needed to encourage more immigrants to move here, do you think, David? And has there been anything tried like this before?
Well, in the past, if you go back many years, there were, back in the 50s under the Eisenhower administration, when there were labor shortages, there were seasonal workers that came in and did work and then left. And effectively, we have seen that happen with undocumented immigrants in more recent years. But your question gets to something else, which is that there isn't just one solution here. I wrote about immigration because I wanted to carve off that piece and look at it in some depth. But, you know, it also could be that we incentivize workers who are nearing retirement age to work past age 65 in certain key industries. It could be, again, that Foxconn turns out to be a worker magnet, which is what happened up in the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota when the shale oil was discovered up there. And so it could be a variety of solutions that gets to the problem. And we probably have some time, but we do need to begin thinking about it. And again, the key thing that has to happen is you have to figure out a way to reform the immigration process so that people who are now here on an undocumented basis get legalized and can come out of the shadows. A lot of these folks are working, but they're working in jobs and being paid in cash or whatever, and they're not really working up to their full potential.
David, thank you so much for being with us.
You bet.
David D. Haynes is editorial editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us from our Milwaukee studios to talk about a recent piece that he wrote looking at immigration as part of a solution to a tight labor market in Wisconsin. First, after several previous failed attempts to pass in Congress, the Hmong Veterans Service Recognition Act was signed into law by President Trump late last month. The bill was introduced by Congressman Jim Acosta, a Democrat whose district in California includes one of the largest Hmong communities in the U.S. Here he is in 2015 when he unsuccessfully reintroduced the bill.
This legislation would allow the burial of these Hmong veterans who live here today and their families in national cemeteries, like the San Joaquin Valley National Cemetery in Merced County. This recognition is long overdue. We granted it to Filipino soldiers who fought side by side with American soldiers in World War II. I hope my colleagues will support this legislation to ensure that those Hmong veterans and their families receive the proper recognition by providing them burial rights that they have earned.
Chia Yuyi Vang is a professor in the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and is the director of UWM's Hmong Diaspora Studies Program. Chia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Can you briefly tell us how Hmong soldiers came to fight alongside American troops in the Vietnam War?
Well, it's a very long story, right? I think we know a lot about what happened during the Vietnam era, and we know that it wasn't, you know, that the name of the Vietnam War has come to be sort of an inaccurate description of what actually happened in that part of the world. So it's a Vietnam War, but I think as I've talked to many people, the people in Asia call it the American War. So in fact, it's, you know, called the Vietnam War, but it involved, you know, many other countries in the region, and in particular Laos and Cambodia, largely because they share a border with Vietnam. And so it's a long story, but to make it short for our purpose today, the U.S. was really building up its involvement in Vietnam. And as we know, by the late 1950s, the northern Vietnamese leaders had decided that they would support the South in a more aggressive response to American buildup. And so part of why the Hmong became entangled in this war was because of the strategic location in which they lived, near the Vietnamese border, partly in the northeastern part of Laos. And so they became part of what the strategy of the United States, recruiting, involving many ethnic minorities to fight on their side.
How many Hmong, do we know how many Hmong served during the course of what you said is considered the American War in Southeast Asia?
Mm-hmm. Well, the estimates are that from, you know, the early 1960s, 61, 62, when, you know, Kennedy really supported these counterinsurgency, you know, efforts around the world, it began with a small number, with just about 1,000 people trained by American special forces. But by the end of the war, the estimated number of Hmong troops have been about 40,000. And we have to remember that this is out of a population of about roughly 300,000 at that time. So about 40,000 Hmong combatants fought, you know, on behalf of the United States in what is called, you know, the Secret War of Laos.
And how many Hmong ended up coming to the United States after that?
So if we think about the larger Vietnam War refugees, right, after 1975, after what most people remember as the fall of Saigon, we have about close to 2 million people from the former Indochinese colonies of Laos, Vietnam, and Cambodia who left those countries after the Vietnam War. And about 1.4 million came to the United States. And of those, I mean, the majority are Vietnamese, but of that 1.4 million refugees that came to the U.S., about 10%, right? Mm-hmm. About 140,000, a little bit more than 140,000 were Hmong.
And Chia, how is military service on behalf of the Americans viewed in the Hmong community?
For the Hmong, I think for the soldiers, for the officers who served at the time, I think it was a very honorable thing to do because they were also serving the United States, again, fighting, you know, communism at the time. But they were also very much protecting, you know, our families as well. Mm-hmm. And I say our because, you know, I was a child then. And so for them, it was an honorable service that they were, you know, sacrificing themselves to protect, you know, our people as well as fighting for this greater cause. But I think the honest truth is that many people at the time, now in retrospect, you know, in hindsight it's 2020, but at the time, even the military leaders, I've interviewed many, many people, and if people are very honest with themselves, now we know about, you know, what happened and how the U.S., the CIA recruited Hmong to be their soldiers in Laos. But at the time, many people didn't know the larger geopolitical issues. So the awareness became increased as they lived in this country. So it's a very honorable thing for them. And now that they better understand the larger political issues, many who served are very proud for having, you know, participated. But then they also are very bitter. I think many talk about the fact that family and friends and the thousands of people who died, and then the war ended the way it did, right? And so mm-hmm. they are displaced from their homes. Many appreciate being in this country, the opportunities for, you know, people like my generation, the children. But for the elders who served, I mean, they were born to live a very different life, and then they're transplanted into a society that's completely different. Mm. So whereas they were in a place where they felt honored and they felt they were in charge and they were providing for their families, and then they come to the United States and many have to start all over. In many ways, they didn't speak English. They've had very limited formal education. So just that kind of, overview of their experiences of war, becoming refugees and then migrating to a foreign land. It's been, I think, a very contentious, a difficult journey for the Hmong people who resettle in the United States. But I would like to say that I have traveled all over, you know, the different places in Europe and in South America that other Hmong refugees resettled. And I would like to say that despite the challenges in the United States, Hmong Americans have had a great deal of support, more than the other locations, largely because of the higher number of refugees who came to this country. And many of us have settled in, you know, as you know, in places like California, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, the three largest state Hmong populations, and people are then able to support each other. So the isolation is initially very difficult, but over time, people build community and a sense of place and sense of belonging much easier than in very isolated places like in Argentina or in other places in Europe.
We're talking with Chia Yuyi Vang about the recently passed Hmong Veterans Service Recognition Act. She's a professor in the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and is the director of UWM's Hmong Diaspora Studies Program. And before we wrap up, Chia, I want to make sure we do talk about the Hmong Veterans Service Recognition Act that was signed into law by President Trump late last month. What does this act specifically provide?
Well, it's sort of a progression, right? Hmong veterans, right when they set foot on this country, have been fighting for a very long time, beginning in, you know, the late 1970s, because of the Sikh War, right? It wasn't supposed to happen. It was happening. Congress appropriated funding over time. But in terms of the American public, people didn't know that exactly the nature of the war in Laos. So Hmong showed up in this country, and then the education began. So the awareness of their involvement and the extent of the sacrifices and struggles and tragedy for our people became more known only because we became refugees and lived in this country. So this bill is a sort of a part of a long fight that veterans in the community and Americans who served in Laos or American political leaders who have been fighting to recognize Hmong. As you may already know, in 2000, President Clinton signed into law the Hmong Veterans Naturalization Act, which helped to ease the citizenship process for veterans and their families. So this particular legislation, the Hmong Veterans Recognition Act, is very instrumental, I think, for the people who served as well as for the younger generation, because we understand more about our sacrifices. And I think having the United States, having Congress, having the U.S. recognize the services of our elders, for the veterans, they've been waiting for this for a long time. And this legislation, basically what it does is that it enables, it changes, part of the federal legislation that allows veterans to be buried at American National Cemetery. So the legislation is a big win in a way for the Hmong veterans. For those who served and supported U.S. Armed Forces in Laos during the Vietnam War, they are able to be buried at national cemeteries, with the exception of Arlington National Cemetery. Mm-hmm.
And the way the act is written, my understanding is that this applies to veterans who pass away now and in the future. Obviously, many of these veterans are quite elderly and many have passed away already. Do we know how many veterans who are still alive this would possibly affect?
Yeah, the estimate, there's a number of Hmong veterans groups, so average about, they estimate about maybe a little over 6,000 of the Secret War veterans who are still alive who could benefit from this legislation.
Well, Chia, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chia Yuyi Vang is a professor in the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and is the director of UWM's Hmong Diaspora Studies Program. She joined us to discuss the significance of the recently passed Hmong Veterans Service Recognition Act. First, two of Wisconsin's big three in Republican politics have stepped away from the national stage or are about to. Reince Priebus resigned as chief of staff for the Trump administration last year. And earlier this month, House Speaker Paul Ryan announced that he will not run for re-election in November and doesn't expect to ever run for office again. Craig Gilbert is the Washington bureau chief for Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's with us now to look back at the Cheesehead Revolution and discuss the political forces that may be bringing it to a close. Craig, thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you.
So remind us, what was the Cheesehead Revolution?
So it was a name that got attached to these three men from Wisconsin who became leading Republican figures nationally. I think it all came together after the 2010 election when Scott Walker got elected, and then you had Paul Ryan continuing his ascent in the Republican Party in Washington and eventually being tapped as Mitt Romney's running mate in 2012, then eventually becoming the House Speaker, and Reince Priebus, who became, after chairing the state party in Wisconsin at a time when the state party was making big gains, then became chairman of the national party, endured some bumps, but his party eventually triumphed in 2016, and then he became White House chief of staff. So, partly just the coincidence of having these three figures, similar generations, guys who were friends and came up together, ascending together from one state, experiencing a lot of political success, and now in the Trump era going through some downs as well as ups.
So they had some kind of basic, almost demographic things in common, but what about ideology? Where did they meet on points of agreement?
I would say all three of them, in some ways were fairly orthodox Republican conservatives, I think all thought of themselves as in the tradition of Ronald Reagan Republicanism. And by that I just mean, the classic triad of conservative on social issues, conservative on national security issues, and conservative on economic issues, particularly on the economic front, smaller government. In some ways conventional conservatives, but what they did, particularly Ryan and Walker, is they really pushed the envelope in trying to realize some fairly bold policy goals that maybe had been conservative goals in the past, but but people didn't really think they were achievable. And the classic example in Walker's case was his big fight with the public sector unions and doing a lot of things beyond that in Wisconsin that were on the conservative wish list. And in Paul Ryan's case, not necessarily having policy success with all of his ideas, but he certainly, you know, he certainly took what was considered kind of a third rail issue, like entitlement reform, and made it more of a mainstream position within the Republican Party. And so I think of them as being pretty bold in their political and policy ambitions, and having some success both personally and particularly in the case of Walker, and also Priebus, political election success as well.
So the three of them were on a national stage at the same time, Walker obviously being governor, but getting a lot of attention nationally. What drew national Republicans and the party as a whole to this particular brand of kind of heartland conservatism?
Again, I think part of it was just the political success they had. Walker became sort of a darling of the Republican Party as a governor because of his huge fight with Democrats and because of his sort of MO of really pushing the envelope and winning and kind of withstanding the blowback and taking a state that is a purple state, but a state where Democrats have had their share of success and certainly had been voting consistently Democratic for president, and then just bringing his party to a new level of dominance in that state and kind of a take-no-prisoners approach tactically and strategically as well. So I think that, you know, that was kind of a, became sort of a model. You saw some other states doing, you know, Republican governors in some other states trying to do some of the same things. And again, in Paul Ryan, over the long arc of his young career, you know, kind of became the point man in his party on budget issues, on fiscal issues, a spokesman for his party, and then again, obviously leading to his ascendance as House Speaker, although first to the Republican presidential ticket as Mitt Romney's running mate in 2012.
We're talking with Craig Gilbert right now. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're talking about whether the cheesehead revolution has come to an end or at least is in a low point right now. And Craig, what was the first sign that maybe this triumvirate of these conservatives from Wisconsin who were, you know, getting a lot of attention on the national stage might not have the staying power that we thought?
Well, I think in the case of Paul Ryan, you know, the jury has always been out about whether some of the boldest policies he was pursuing were popular in a broad sense. And so one sign was when the Romney-Ryan ticket not only lost nationally, but lost in Wisconsin in 2012, handily. So Paul Ryan's, you know, kind of the degree of popularity he had in Wisconsin certainly wasn't enough to overcome Barack Obama's popularity in the state. Then you had Scott Walker's, you know, presidential run starting in 2015, and really two chapters of that story. I mean, he came out of the gate, and for some of the reasons we've been talking about, became kind of a, you know, almost like not a front runner, but just kind of this ascendant figure in the Republican primaries in the pre-election year. It's what they call the invisible primary, when nobody's really voting, but it's all about media, it's all about attention, it's all about the activists. And if you remember, Scott Walker, you know, looked like kind of a shooting star there for a while until Donald Trump came along and was utterly eclipsed by Donald Trump to the point where I think he only made it through two presidential primary debates and ended up having to drop out of the race, being kind of driven from the race by Donald Trump, really couldn't compete with Donald Trump on a personal level. And also, you know, one of the takeaways from Scott Walker's failed presidential bid was some of us thought that whoever the Republicans nominated in 2016 would be a conservative who sort of checked all the conservative boxes, who was more orthodox in their conservatism. And Scott Walker certainly did that, and to no avail. I mean, utterly eclipsed by Donald Trump, this unconventional, obviously a political outsider, but also someone who, you know, who was not a conventional conservative in a lot of ways. And you really saw that contrast when Donald Trump came into Wisconsin and campaigned for the Wisconsin presidential primary in the spring of 2016 and just ran into all sorts of flack from conservative talk radio, didn't do very well in the Wisconsin primary before kind of resuming his march to the Republican nomination. So those were some of the bumps, some of the signs, and then obviously as Trump ascended, each of these three figures went through their own, you know, they kind of went through the Trump, you know, kind of storm in their own way and encountered a lot of turbulence as a result.
Well, and it seems like Reince Priebus was viewed as possibly someone who could rein in Donald Trump a little bit, or at least be, you know, some kind of a Trump whisperer, and that didn't work out too well.
No, and he's an interesting case. Again, he's different from Walker and Ryan in the sense that he's not an elected politician. He's not a, you know, he's somebody that was more of a nuts and bolts Republican fundraiser and organizer. And I think you could certainly give him some of the credit in the 2016 election for building a kind of an infrastructure in the Republican Party when it came to data, when it came to the ground game, certainly when it came to fundraising. And to the point where, oddly enough, because Trump was such an outsider, Reince Priebus was seen coming into the Trump presidency as like the Washington insider, when he really wasn't even a Washington insider. He was a guy that had worked his way up through the party at the local and state level in Wisconsin, had not spent a whole lot of time in Washington, and the sum total of his Washington experience was really as chairman of the Republican National Committee. So in retrospect, you know, his troubles as White House chief of staff, I think, went beyond just trying to manage the unmanageable president of Donald Trump, but also just the fact that he really didn't have that longevity and background in Washington that people ascribe to him. But in relation to a lot of the other Trump people, he kind of looked like the quintessential insider.
We're talking with Craig Gilbert. He's the Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's with us to talk about the Cheesehead Revolution, now that two of its biggest stars either are no longer on the national stage or are planning to step back. And we want to hear from you. Were you a conservative excited about the rise of Wisconsin Republicans? What do you think about the changes they've made during their time in power, and what happens now? Call in and tell us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation now about the Cheesehead Revolution with Craig Gilbert, Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we want to know what you think. What do you think about the change in the Republican Party under President Trump? Do you think it hasn't changed that much, or has it changed too much? Are you satisfied with what the Cheesehead Revolution was able to accomplish? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. So, Craig, now Paul Ryan has announced he will not seek re-election. Reince Priebus is working as a private citizen again. Is the Cheesehead Revolution over on the national scale?
Well, I mean, one big part of the story that hasn't been written yet is sort of what happens to Scott Walker this year. I mean, he's on the ballot. He's running for a third term. It's his fourth statewide election when you add the recall election into the picture. And yet he faces his toughest kind of election climate ever, largely because of the Trump presidency. It's always harder when you're a governor to win when your party is in the White House. And not only that, but you've got a president who's got relatively low approval ratings and is motivating Democrats like crazy. These are things that have complicated Scott Walker's reelection bid. So, you know, we're not going to know until November whether this is the end of Scott Walker's pretty remarkable reign as governor of Wisconsin, or whether he is a guy that survives the early stages of the Trump presidency and keeps on going. You know, Paul Ryan did not survive the Trump presidency. Paul Ryan's probably the first shoe to drop. The first thing that kind of spelled defined the end of his career in Congress was his willingness to become speaker. Speakers don't last very long. And then the second thing was Donald Trump's winning the Republican nomination. The third thing was Donald Trump getting elected president. that created an environment where Paul Ryan's kind of days were numbered, and now he's looking, you know, he was looking at a situation where the Republicans might not even hold their majority, not a very attractive prospect for him continuing his speakership when the speaker is whipsawed between kind of the Trumpiest elements of the Republican Party and other factions in the party. So let's stay tuned and see what happens to Scott Walker and whether all three of these guys are going to be off the stage by next January.
Well, and clearly the factor that has really driven all three of those storylines, Walker not making it very far at all in the Republican primary, Paul Ryan announcing his retirement, Reince Priebus being out of the White House, is Donald Trump. Is this more mismatch in style or in substance between this cheesehead revolution, you know, kind of philosophy and Donald Trump?
Well, I think both things are going on. I think you can overstate the substantive differences in some respects, although they are real. You know, Donald Trump has departed from conservative orthodoxy on issues like trade and to some degree on immigration, even though there's always been a constituency within the Republican Party for his positions on those issues. So there are substantive differences. There's huge stylistic differences, and those are important too, because it's not just about personality. It's also about the message you're sending, your vision for the future of the Republican Party. I mean, just to bring Reince Priebus back into the discussion, if you remember, after the 2012 defeat of Mitt Romney, Reince Priebus, as chairman of the Republican National Committee, commissioned a postmortem on that defeat, and one of their conclusions was the Republican Party needed to do better with Latino voters and get behind a comprehensive solution to the immigration problem. That was done before Donald Trump ended up taking the party really in the opposite direction. So there are important policy differences, but there's also an element, to some degree, this is kind of just a story of disruption and turbulence and turmoil emanating from Donald Trump's style of leadership.
Let's take a very quick call from Joan in Eau Claire. Hi, Joan.
Good afternoon. These Republicans being in office has been a disaster for middle-class people. They've done everything they can to abolish unions. They've slashed funding to public education. They've rolled back environmental regulations. And that includes the damage that Scott Walker has done in Wisconsin. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thanks, Joan. Craig?
So it's another reason why it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the Walker race. We don't know who the Democratic nominee is going to be. We don't know how strong the Democratic nominee is going to be. But already we've seen Scott Walker kind of zig to the center a little bit on some issues where he's kind of vulnerable in this environment. Healthcare and education are two of them. He's put some, after cutting education in the state, he's put some new money into education. And he's done some things on healthcare that are kind of widely seen in Madison as efforts to kind of appeal to some of the same kinds of moderate suburban and other voters who are fretful about Donald Trump and who weren't crazy about all the things that Scott Walker did in his earlier budgets. I mean, part of Scott Walker's plunge in popularity after 2015 involved his failed presidential bid, but also he had submitted a budget that was not particularly popular with the public in Wisconsin. So he's done a little bit of a course correction in that respect, and one of his strategies for surviving the Trump midterms is, along with trying to mobilize Republican voters, and in some ways, you know, even mobilize Trump voters, he's also trying to appeal to some swing voters, some voters who maybe want to see a more moderate agenda.
Well, Craig, thank you so much for joining us today.
Anytime.
Craig Gilbert is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to look at the Cheesehead Revolution and what its status is now. 50 years ago today, Milwaukee adopted its open housing ordinance. That move came more than 2 weeks after President Lyndon Johnson signed the Federal Fair Housing Act. The laws barred discrimination based on factors like race, sex, or religion. But some area housing advocates argue that there are still loopholes in the federal and Milwaukee laws. As Jimena Conde reports, some Milwaukee County officials are trying to close one.
Chandra Williams is looking for a recent picture of her son, Wilbert McDonald, in her three-bedroom Milwaukee apartment.
Okay, it's not going to be here. And I'll show you the rest of the house.
It's Tuesday, and she won't see him until the weekend. He's a senior at Waukesha North High School, about 30 minutes away.
My son is a week at a time in Waukesha just to keep his grades up, to get to school every day on time and not dragged out tired.
Williams and her son lived in Waukesha until last August. She wanted him to finish high school there, where he played football well enough to earn a scholarship to Iowa State. But Williams relies on a Section 8 voucher to pay rent. She ended up in the program about 10 years ago, after being diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer while homeless. Williams says finding landlords that accept Section 8 was always difficult in Waukesha.
Some people said, oh, we don't accept rent assistance. And I'm like, why? Well, they tear up our units and it's hard to get them out. I'm like, okay, so I moved to the next unit. We don't accept rent assistance. Move to the next one. No rent assistance. It was really, really, really hard.
Williams had her rent assistance transferred to Milwaukee, even though it would mean uprooting her son's life. The search there was just as challenging.
You're kind of like desperate to find something. And so you kind of begin to settle. And that's the process of having rent assistance.
It becomes a thin veil for racial discrimination.
That's Margaret Rosga. She's been advocating for fair housing in Milwaukee for more than 50 years. Rosga took part in 200 nights of marches in the city for open housing in 1967 and 68. She eventually married one of the men who led them, Father James Grappi. She says the ability of landlords to turn away Section 8 recipients is a loophole in the civil rights law they fought for. That's why she's supporting a county proposal to ban rent assistance discrimination.
Giving people who have vouchers some way to get out of neighborhoods of high poverty concentration where the rents aren't actually cheaper.
Nearly 1,800 people in Milwaukee County receive the vouchers, and almost three-quarters are people of color. County Supervisor Marina Dmitrievich introduced the discrimination ban and says feedback she's heard from the opposition is based on stereotypes.
Those tenants. I don't want to take Section 8 because of those things.
Ron Hegwood is a landlord and president of the Apartment Association of Southeastern Wisconsin. He says he understands the desire to desegregate, but he points out that rents for Section 8 recipients are capped by neighborhood. He says that puts landlords and other renters at a disadvantage.
We all want to live where we want to live, but if you can't afford to live there, you have to go with the choices you have. I mean, you're putting in a law in effect to create a protected class at everybody else's expense, and I think that's wrong.
Landlords also say they've had bad experiences getting reimbursed for damage done to units. Hegwood says if the ordinance passes, the association will lobby state legislators. Corey Schneider-Perigini knows the measure won't be enough to undo the segregation in Milwaukee's neighborhoods. She's with the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council and helped craft the proposal.
It's about, you know, where our kids are educated. It's about our correctional system. There's so many components to segregation, but this is one area, I think, where we can start to have an effect.
Housing advocate Margaret Rosga agrees it's a small step, but she says that's all the more reason to take it. Jimena Conde, Wisconsin Public Radio.